This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
This is the 11th hour, and I'm Páraic Branach. The British writer Jim Crace is the author of 9 novels and 1 collection of short stories and has been the recipient of numerous literary awards. He's been shortlisted for the Booker Prize twice, in 1997 for Quarantine and in 1999 for Being Dead. He began his writing career in journalism, where he worked for 16 years before the success of his first novel, Continent, in 1986, allowed him to concentrate on fiction writing. His latest novel, The Pest House, has just been published, and Jim Crace joins me now in the studio to tell us about his work. Jim, you're very welcome to the 11th Hour.
Thank you, Páraic.
I was just thinking about it must be a strange one, sitting down for 9 months writing a novel and then going around the next 3 months promoting it. Which do you prefer, promotion or the writing?
Well, I used to be a journalist for many years, right. And when you're a journalist, you talk all the time and you have colleagues. And if I were to be asked what it is I most miss about journalism, that's what I miss. I miss the colleagues, I miss the conversation. I do enjoy being by myself, dealing with fiction and narrative, seeing where it leads. But actually, pretty much all the time, I'm longing to be chatting rather than sitting and saying nothing. And so, for me, unlike some writers, it's a relief. I love going out doing promotion. And don't believe any writer that tells you that they hate promotion, because the worst thing that you want when you publish a book is that no one takes any notice. So when I encounter other writers that make a fuss and say, I can't bear doing interviews, I can't bear doing readings, I think, oh, you know, that's ungracious, is what I think.
Well, it's not the way to do your business, I suppose.
No, we all want it. We didn't enter this profession in order to be grand and to say, I can't be bothered to speak to my readers. I can't be bothered to talk about my work. There are so many books around these days that... If you don't enjoy writing, stop doing it. You know, you're a volunteer, is my attitude.
Did be a journalist for 16 years. How did that contribute? How did that contribute to your life as a novelist?
Well, it was weird, really, because I'm a very puritanical person politically. And so when I was a journalist, I played a very straight bat. I believed that the facts are eloquent on their own behalf. And if you tell the truth, that you're going to be able to convince people of your case. But personally, naturally, before I took up journalism, I'm a liar by nature. I was always a big fibber when I was a kid.
Fantasist.
I was always a fantasist. I could never understand why people were put out by it, because I thought that if you had a story to tell, if you improved it when you were telling people, that this was sociable. It was generous to tell a story with little added bits on and making the punchline fall in the right place, exaggerating the right instances. I saw that as an act of generosity and sociability, whereas very often the people who would listen to me would reply by saying, you little liar. And I was baffled by that. When I became a journalist, this puritanical journalist, it was as if I was acting out the part of another person that wasn't truly me. I was desperate to make things up, but I was too puritanical to do it. I promise you, I really was. So when journalism came to an end, and it came to an end not because I wanted it to come to an end, it was because I had a political falling out with an editor. When it came to an end and I was forced into writing fiction, it was as if suddenly I'd found myself. You know, I could tell lies for a living and no one was upset by it, because that's what fiction writers are allowed to do. They're allowed to make things up.
What's interesting about your books, I think, is that you create a world.
Yeah.
Like The Pest House, you've created a new world, a new environment, a new religion, a new philosophy.
Yeah.
Do you set up those constraints on yourself to write within before when you start?
It's the one thing that people might hate about my work, is that I never hold a mirror up to a real world. I'm not in the realist tradition. And I like the realist tradition. It's a convention now to hold a mirror up to the real world and you say, yes, you know, if you set a book in Dublin, you want to read a book about Dublin which says Dublin looks like that, it smells like that, and it tastes like that. You want to get it right. But I don't do that. And it's simply because I don't have those skills. My skills are other than that. If you're lucky enough as a writer to discover your own voice, then you need to stick to it. And the voice that I wanted to have when I was a 17-year-old political activist, I wanted to be a realist writer. I wanted to be a writer like Orwell or Steinbeck that set new agendas, that changed the hearts and minds of men and women. But when I started writing those political realist books, I didn't know what the next sentence was, let alone the next paragraph. But when I discovered Gabriel García Márquez, and I realised that there was a style of fiction that you could just invent things, make things up, you know, invent landscapes, invent animals, invent traditions, then I knew what the next 10 books were. And so even though that was the kind of book that my 17-year-old political self would have sneered at, that was my voice. I make things up. If I'm going to have an animal in a chapter, I'd rather invent an animal than have an existing animal. I'm doing it to amuse myself. I apologise to my readers, but that is my tone of voice.
And do you sort of like make notes or plot logically what the parameter of this world is, what's possible in this world before you put the characters into the picture?
No, it's discovery for me. It's deciding what the subject matter for my book is. In the case of The Pest House, it was how much do I love America, how much do I hate America? Try and find the answer to that. And what would the world look like from the future if the future were medieval rather than highly technological? So those are the questions I wanted answered. But I had no plot, I had no characters, I had no setting. I just embark upon it as if it's a mystery tour. And the reason I do that, because I'm on my own every day, as I said earlier. It's not a very sexy job. No one phones. The neighbours think you're weird. So what do I want to do? I'm not an autobiographical writer, so I'm not investigating my own life. What I want to do is to have fun with narrative. Narrative has been with us for thousands of years. It knows a lot. If you write a prescriptive novel of the kind that you were suggesting, in which all the decisions are made beforehand, then when narrative knocks on the door and says, I want to go in a different direction, you don't hear it. And if you don't hear the wise advice of narrative itself, then you're stuck in a rut. So what I do is I go along and I hope that very soon when I start to write a book, the book itself will abandon me, the writer, and that the narrative will take over. And that's exactly what happened in The Pest House. I did not write the book that I set out to write. Narrative itself dictated it, that it followed a different direction.
And in terms of research for a book like The Pest House, do you have to research it, or is it all total invention? The environment, because the environment is so elaborate or so detailed in The Pest House.
Well, I don't do any research, no. I don't do any research, but I know a lot about natural history.
Right.
You know, so it does come out of my background. Of course, anyone that reads one of my books is going to encounter a lot of natural history. Sorry, readers. And a lot of landscape. Landscape is almost a character in all of my books. I couldn't invent those landscapes and that natural history, and a lot of it is largely invented, unless I knew a lot about it. You know, if, for example, I were to write a book set in a chemical laboratory, I would be at a total loss because I don't have the background to invent chemistry. But I do have the background to invent natural history. So I don't have to research. It's an area of expertise that I can invent versions of without much trouble.
So we have the parameters, we have the narrative. When do the characters appear?
Yeah, sometimes they only appear when they appear on the page.
Really?
You know, I'll give you an example from an earlier novel, my novel Quarantine, which is set in the desert.
This is the 40 time, days and 40 nights.
40 days and 40 nights. That book was supposed to be about Jesus Christ at all. I mean, I'm a hard-nosed North Korean-style atheist. I wasn't going to write a book about Jesus Christ. But what I wanted to do was to have a paragraph referring to him so that readers would be located. They get a sense of what was going on and, you know, the whole idea of people going into the wilderness to meet their devils. I wrote the paragraph. And I remember the day I wrote it. I wrote the paragraph, and somehow or other it was unresolved. It was more interesting, and so I took the character a bit further. By the end of that chapter, at the end of that day, Jesus had come in for the paragraph, but he'd lasted till the end of the chapter, and he'd also brought about a miracle. Or was it a miracle? We're not sure. But he'd actually, his presence had made a man believe, a man that was dying, that he was cured. So the book made me take the character and stick with the character of Jesus all the way through. I could never have predicted that. It was the narrative itself saying to me, you've got to keep the character in the book and not drop him. Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury, I hate to drop names, but when the year when that won the Whitbread Award for the novel of the year, the Archbishop of Canterbury was one of the judges, and he said to me, oh, that was the good Lord standing at your shoulder while you were writing it. And I said to him, not so, Archbishop, it was the imp of storytelling. And storytelling is a very, very mischievous, I don't want to call it a creature, but it's a very mischievous presence. And it will take you in all sorts of odd directions. And some writers will resist it, but some writers, like me, will be happy when it happens and will feel glorious. Even though, very often, it means that you've written a book that doesn't truly represent what you believe yourself.
That's what I was going to ask you. What did the Archbishop of Canterbury think of your the North Korean communist version of Jesus Christ?
Well, that was it. The North Korean version of Jesus Christ disappeared because the narrative didn't want it. So if I'd have written a leaflet about atheism, I would have upset the Archbishop of Canterbury. But because the narrative had followed its own direction, I'd ended up writing a very scriptural book, the kind of book that my atheist self could never have written. I don't mind that. I mean, you know, there has to be certain limitations. You can't write racist books or homophobic books or sexist books. I wouldn't allow that to happen. But nearly all of my books sort of struggle free of me. This book, The Pest House, was intended to be a blow against America. I was going to take America and place it at the bottom of the pile from which it would not recover. Why was that? Because my cousin, America, had let me down because of its foreign policy, and just to express it simply. Mm. So I wanted to give America a medieval future, and it would be flattened by the tricks that I was playing on it. But the foolish thing that the thing that the foolish me forgot to take into account was that the American traditions of storytelling are hundreds of years old. And those traditions have one thing in common: go west, young man. So it doesn't matter whether you look at Grapes of Wrath, where people are going west in order to get a job, or whether you're looking at Wagon Train, where people are going west to get an acre of land, or whether you're looking at Thelma and Louise, where people are going west to get freedom from the police, or whether you're looking at Borat, where people are going west to get a date with Pamela Anderson. Going west represents all the hopes and aspirations of America, not always hopes that are answered, but hopes that are real. My book tried to send the trajectory of American narrative eastwards, and that was how I was going to deliver a blow to the American dream. But I was struggling with all those 100 years of go west. Now, anyone who reads the book will know which one. Did the message that the writer was trying to force on the book win, or did those hundreds of years of traditional storytelling win? And I have to tell you that the answer is that I have written, against all my expectations, a book that is unambiguously optimistic.
It is. And it's strange how that optimism appears very early on in the book, unbeknownst to you, because this book is set in a post-apocalyptic world of societies falling apart, food is scarce, people are murdering each other, etc., etc. Yeah. Fairly poor show, really. But the optimism is in there from a very early stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Even the first character we meet is Mags, which has been brought to the pest house by her grandfather.
Well, dystopias don't destroy optimism. You know, the human spirit always manages to get from dark places optimism. Just think about something grim, and that is, here we all are. Everyone in this studio is going to die. Absolutely no question of it. You know, there's no bleating you can do, no whining you can do.
Yeah, but don't need to be facing up to that every day. Like.
No, well, I want to remind you today, you're going to die. But the extraordinary thing is, if we didn't have an optimistic streak in our bodies, all of us would spend all our lives rolled up in a fetal position, whining, in total fear of death. But I never fear death. I don't, you know, and probably you never fear death. I hardly give it any thought. It's almost irrational that we don't feel death, given fear death, given that we're conscious animals and that we understand death so entirely. So there's this undefeatable streak of optimism that runs through human beings. And it's not only just found in light places, it's found in the darkest of places. So a lot of people talk about my novels and say they're deeply pessimistic. Actually, they're deeply optimistic, because unlike Hollywood, they go to dark, difficult places to find their optimism. And the optimism of The Pest House is this, that at the end, the unit of optimism that you encounter in The Pest House is the most unlikely of families. It's a couple that are in love with each other but have never kissed, never had sex with each other. They've got a child, but the child is a stolen child, and they've got a horse. You know, this is the American nuclear family, a horse, a child, and two virgins. Mm. And there they are at the end of the book, poised to follow the American dream again, poised full of hope and full of fear, in exactly the same way that those emigrants from Ireland would have been in the 19th century, fleeing the potato famine, or those Shetel Jews from Russia fleeing there in the 19th century, or those Iranians fleeing in the 20th century to America. You never know that the dream is going to be realised, but there's something very touching about the fact that even in the worst circumstances, people can imagine something better and are prepared to reach out for it. So that's what this book is about.
I found it fascinating, the book, I must say, in, you know, they've just been chased by slave traders and so on and so forth, and this whole couple end up making love in a wet, old, fallen down barn after a really traumatic day. And you're
that was the older couple. That's not the main couple. Yeah,
your older couple. Well, the young couple never got together at all.
Yeah. I've done it. I it was almost like I was defying people to make a film of this book. You've got the two main attractive characters who never have sex. You can imagine, you can just see the Hollywood moguls saying, oh, we can't make
that's
a film
with
that.
Work.
That's going to have to change. But I've got this: the two ugly, unpleasant characters in their 60s having sex, which is, I'm in my 60s, so I know it happens. and I find that, you know, that was quite a touching moment for me.
Yeah, it was a very touching moment in the book, in the middle of it, and the way the narration came out of that and described that even the darkest of places, and that was a fairly dark corner.
Yeah, but if there is a film, I bet you don't see that scene. No one's allowed to have sex in American movies unless
there was another
under 30.
But in the middle of it all, it's a love story.
Yeah. But it's another love story of a kind as well. It's a love story about America. I feel so strongly about America because I feel America is my cousin. You know, we have so much in common. The same language and the culture is... we share so much of American culture. America is a close friend of mine. So when it lets me down, which it has done over its foreign policy, I feel it quite deeply. But the answer that I've got from this book is that despite all that, my love affair with America has deepened through writing this book rather than become more shallow. It's reminded me how much I love the landscape there. It's reminded me how much I love the homespun philosophy. It's reminding me how much I love the generous hospitality of America. I'm going next month to do a book tour in America, 17 cities in 21 days, can you imagine? But I'm looking forward to it enormously because we pretend that we hate everything American, but actually what we hate is the fact that we are so easily seduced by wonderful American coffee, wonderful American hamburgers, you know, CNN, all of those things that we sneer at. They're really under our skin. And what we hate about America is the same thing that we admire about America, and that's its success and its inability to keep within its own frontiers, as it were.
But the narrative in this book is interesting because it's a post-technology narrative. Mm. You have to walk, you have to drag, you have to push your barrow.
Yeah.
Does that make the characters think in a different way? Like, you know, when you're on the road with Jack Kerouac with a Cadillac, it's not the same as pushing a barrow down.
It certainly isn't. You know, we take everything for granted. For example, we take the sea. We see the sea as the place that you go to have a slow journey because we've now got jets and we've now got motor cars. Everything fast happens on land. But in a pre-technological or post-technological age or in the Middle Ages, when you got to the coast, that great heavy burden that you're carrying suddenly becomes light because water makes impossible burdens no longer heavy. And so the sea actually was the fast transport rather than the slow transport. And all those kind of things please me. I enjoy discovering those things.
But the sea was a disappointment for the characters when they got there. They were going towards the sea for the whole journey. Yeah. When they got there, it was a huge disappointment.
Well, I don't think the sea itself was. I think they were pretty impressed by the physicality of the sea, and they were baffled by it because they're only used to lakes. But they couldn't get passage there because, as is true of almost the whole of the world these days, people don't move freely around the world. I mean, people can't move into England as they want to now or into America as they want to. They've got to satisfy certain criteria. And my characters couldn't emigrate because one was a woman seemingly with a child, and Europe only wanted young, unmarried women and fit men. And you know what the satire of that is saying.
I think something to do with a guy in a stable out in Bethlehem or something.
You got it.
Jim Grace, thank you very much for being with us in the 11th Hour.
Porrick, thank you.
The Pest House is published by Picador. You're listening to the 11th Hour with me, Porrick Branagh. The American writer James Salter has written novels, short stories and screenplays and is, according to the author Richard Ford, one of the finest stylists writing today. Born in 1925, James Salter entered the West Point Military Academy at the age of 17 and subsequently joined the Army Air Corps, where he was an officer for a dozen years and was involved in more than 100 combat missions as a fighter pilot in the Korean War. His first novel, The Hunters, was published in 1956 and was made into a film starring Robert Mitchum. His first collection of short stories, Dusk and Other Stories, was published in 1988 and was awarded the Penn Faulkner Award. This year, a number of Salter's books have just been reissued, including a memoir, Burning the Days, and a collection of short stories, Last Night. And James Salter joins me now in the 11th Hour studio. Mr. Salter, sir, you're very welcome to the 11th Hour.
Thank you.
Your memoir, Burning the Days, you describe as a recollection. It evokes many aspects of your life. But you said you undertook this task reluctantly.
Yes. Well, despite everything that's going to follow here, I don't normally like to speak about myself. I'm more interested in other people's stories. And what had happened was once the editor of a magazine in New York, Esquire, had asked me to come to lunch. High honor, I thought this will be something important. And we sat down. There were three of us, actually. And the editor said, "Now, look, we're doing a different kind of issue in a couple of months. It's not going to have all the pages and pages of text. It's going to be small pieces, just snippets, maybe paragraphs, a lot of illustrations. But there'll be four major pieces, the piers upon which the whole issue will rest. And one of them, I think, is going to be about love and marriage. Now, you've been married five or six times, so I thought you, I said, wait. No, no, that's not right. You've been misinformed. I've been married really just once, 1.5 times, maybe. I don't know any more about it than you do. And he said, oh, well. There's a silence for a moment. He said, well, what are we going to do here? I said, well, it just came to me. I said, I could write a piece about love and honor because there occurred to me, oh, the first woman I was madly in love with actually was a chaste relationship, but intense nonetheless. And her husband was my closest friend. So I suggested this, and he said, oh, that could be great. So I wrote it. It was called The Captain's Wife. And my editor at Random House read it and said, that's one of the best things you've ever written. Why don't you write a number of others that are autobiographical? This piece was, I mean, and we'll make a book of it. So that's how it started. I thought, well, perhaps it won't be too hard. But it proved to be quite hard. What was the difficulty? Well, I was starting from my childhood, and I was well past childhood. And I wanted to write a book that was not entirely imagination and fantasy. And, you know, a lot of these autobiographies are not to be trusted completely. So I went back, and I got all the letters I had written as a kid and went to all the places I could return to and looked at journals and talked to people who were still around. And in short, I did it as if it were a biography. And in the end, I didn't want to write a complete biography, autobiography of myself. And I took as models, more or less, two books, or at least I was stimulated by them. One of them was Isaac Dinesen's Out of Africa. And the other was Nabokov's Speak Memory. Both those books are fragmentary. Nabokov's is only about his till he became 21 or 22, with a little glimpse into the future occasionally. And Isaac Dinesen's book, of course, is just essentially about her years on that coffee plantation. And yet both of them give a full picture of the writer, even though you don't know all the details. And I thought that's the sort of thing I would like to do, since I'm not fond of writing in the first person anyway. And that's what I attempted to do. And also that's why it's called Recollection rather than an autobiography or a memoir or something. There are things purposely left out that I don't know. Now I understand they might be interesting to people, but the hell with it. I didn't put them in.
But memoir... On this side of the Atlantic is usually a name associated with military men, generals who have served in India or in Africa, come home and in their retirement they write their memoirs.
Yeah.
But you started off as a military man. You went to military college at 17, West Point.
Yes, I never really became a general, however. I was when I left the service, I was still in awe of generals.
That must have been a very strange experience as a young man going into this very rigid, very old-fashioned code of honor stuff, West Point.
Yeah, well, I came out of a prep school that was just an ordinary school, very high academic standards. But my father had gone to West Point, and he'd been honor man at West Point. That is to say, first in his class. He never spoke much about it. That was something that I didn't really appreciate once I got there, that he'd never given me some hints. But he was the one that led me to it, actually. It wasn't a question of suggestion. He made it clear that he would like me to apply to West Point. I thought, it's my duty as a son to apply. I had applied to a couple of other colleges as well, of course. And the system was that it still is, that each congressman or senator has so many appointments to give. So they all have, all the states are represented, and they have people in each class and so forth. We were not politically connected. He went to a congressman up in the Bronx that he happened to somehow have met and asked him whether he might be able to get an appointment for me to West Point. And the congressman said, well, I can't do that. I've given out my appointment already. And I've also given out the first alternate to it. But he called his secretary. He said, can we? Yeah, all right. We can let you have the second alternate. Well, that's behind two other people. No chance of my going, right? But what happened, very oddly enough, the first guy flunked the physical. The second guy flunked the mental. And I got a telegram saying, you're admitted to the military academy. It was more or less of a surprise. I didn't expect to go.
After your training in West Point, you ended up in the Air Corps.
My particular class, which was one of the first to send people into pilot training while we were at West Point. In other words, instead of spending the summer shooting cannon, running around in the woods and digging foxholes and all that business, maneuvering, we were off at pilot training. But my two roommates and I all decided on the spur of the moment, let's get out of here. Let's go to pilot training. We have to get off the post here, have to get out of this place. And so that's really why we applied. It was very offhanded. But once we started flying, it was a different matter.
Well, at that time, there was still a romanticism about the men in their flying machines.
Well, there still is. But, yeah, it was a glorious thing. It was simply consuming once you started it, and you felt exactly as what your image of yourself was. Do you know what I mean? You occupied a romantic image that you had held of yourself, and suddenly you found, it's true, I am. And flying itself is glorious. As a pilot.
Yes.
In command of
the machine.
Totally.
And, of course, in military machines, you're talking about the most advanced machines that were available at that time.
That's true. I mean, it's like owning a Ferrari, really. And not only owning it, somebody is paying for the...
For the gas.
Gas, yeah.
You mentioned that, of course, brought you into conflict, being a member of the military, and you went to the Korean War. And in a chapter called A Single Daring Act, you talk about Lorca, for example, in war, and you talk about Goya. But you say in one thing, you say, it's also the furnace of the individual in a way that a life of labour is not. This, that war changes. You talk about big houses being used for small people and quartermasters taking over things. War is a strange time. Have you a romantic image of war, or were you romantic in that war?
Well, I guess I do, because I was a fighter pilot, and you never see anybody hurt. People are either killed, and you don't see that. I mean, you see something far below you hit the ground, a mushroom of flame and black smoke, but nobody ever, or rarely, I mean, it's almost unheard of for somebody to come back wounded. So it's either life or death, one of the two. And so it's quite a different war than the soldiers who are on the ground. And also, I must say, the living conditions of the pilots, well known, you're living not like kings were living in what would in Dublin be a slum, but still, it's dry.
In Korea.
You have showers. You're going down to the mess hall. You're watching films at night and one thing or another. It's not the same as real soldiering. It's a very special aspect of it. Well, you know that, all these romantic... The people are wearing white scarves and saying, to the wind, to the stars, and all this business.
In your book, you talk about, you've written about your life in the military, and you have one piece you want to read to us here?
Yeah, to give an idea of what Burning the Days is like, or at least a portion of it. I was in the I was a fighter pilot in the Air Force. I was a professional officer, a career officer for 12 years, and then I quit. I resigned my commission to become a writer. I must say that that was then, and it remains as I look back, certainly the most difficult decision of my life, and I was immensely uneasy and unhappy about it, having taken it. And I left behind me everybody I had known and everything I had been doing. And among those things I left behind, of course, were people from the last squadron I had been in, which was in Germany. I'd been there for 3 years. And I was the ops officer of a squadron. That's, you know, I had people to order around, pilots, actually. And among them was one pilot who were two. One of them was Aldrin, who later went to the moon. Buzz Aldrin was one of my flight commanders. And also among them was a fellow named Ed White, wonderful guy, wonderful officer, and a good man. And I'd been particularly close to him. I mean, we were not equals. It was not a relationship between equals, but I favored him quite a bit. I liked him and admired him. And now I'm out of the Air Force, and a couple of years have gone by. I'm earning a living in part by being flying with the reserve, with the National Guard. And then you fly on weekends occasionally, and a little bit in the summer. And one night, while I was flying on a cross-country flight, mind you, these are in fighters, right, jet fighters. You're all alone in the plane. And I was navigating across the country at night, logging some time, when this happened. One night, as I was calling for a letdown near St. Louis, the city jewel-like and clear, a voice in the darkness asked, "Flatfoot Red, is that you?" Flatfoot, our call sign from Bitburg, and Red, the color of the lead flight. "Yes," I said, "who's that?" En route, you seldom saw other fighters and almost never recognized the voice. "Ed White." The pleasure, the thrill, in fact, the sort that comes from a lingering glance across a room, a knowing nod or a pair of fingers touched briefly to the brow. We were able to exchange only a few words. "How are you? Where are you headed?" I looked for him in the blackness, the moving star that would be his plane, but the heavens were littered with stars, the earth strewn with lights. He was on his way to somewhere. The heights, I was sure. I was going into land. "See you," he said. Who could know it would be otherwise, and he was the one whom I would never see again. We had flown on the acrobatic team together, he the right wing, Whitlow the left, Tracy in the slot. After his death, his widow remarried, and not many years later, she herself died, apparently a suicide. The waters had closed over them both. I often thought of White, and that hail across the darkness I took as a last meeting. I thought of him as I watched a parade in the city one day. It was November, Armistice Day, but there was the heat and fullness of late summer. The dirt was blowing in the streets. I was part of New York myself by then, returned to it. They came along Fifth Avenue, the ranks of the American Legion, the police and high school bands, teenage girls dressed in blazers, 10-year-old colonels wearing sunglasses, fat men, limpers. The drums went by. The sidewalks were crowded with people. Rows of silver trumpets passed. Then the flags. The crowd watched. Not a hat was lifted. Not a hand raised.
In your collection of stories last night, the title story is 12 pages, 10 or 12 pages, but it packs a punch. Where did that story come from?
It came from something someone told me at a party, actually. That was the kernel of it, and I went on from that.
But it's a very cruel story. in some ways. It's a very tender story in other ways. It's both elements are in it. When the wife agrees, they agree to commit suicide, and it takes the injection, she goes up to bed, assuming she's dead, and the companion that's been with them all night is having an affair with the husband.
Yes.
He helps his wife commit suicide and goes into bed with his lover.
Yes.
What an extraordinary story.
Well, after a funeral, you have a wake, don't you?
Mm.
People drink.
Yes.
They may even joke a bit. They eat and joke. Certainly, they re-embrace life in a certain way. I think this is analogous to that.
Richard Ford described your work and said, you write in lavish sentences with a keen eye for human frailty and occasional heartlessness.
Yes.
What do you make of occasional heartlessness?
Heartlessness?
Yes.
Look, Richard Ford wrote a really brilliant introduction to Light Years, one of these books that's just been reissued. So I'm immensely grateful to him. I would say that I'm not a sentimental writer. I would put it that way, that there's a lack of sentimentality in it, which is a hallmark and you must expect to find in the books. When you read a book, when you open a book, well, I'm speaking for myself now. I don't know average reader, but I open a book and I'm looking for the voice of the writer right away. You can see it on a page. What is that voice? Well, you recognize it immediately. And with good writers, you're able to open a page blindfolded, so to speak, that is to say, without seeing the title of the writer, and say, I know who wrote that. Cheever wrote that. Or no question about that, Updike. Or for that matter, James Joyce wrote that. That's so Joycean. Well, that's his voice. That's the first thing one looks for. But that's not quite enough, right? There has to be some kind of heart in it, some kind of substance which is important to, or that essential connection, that vital connection that you either have or you don't have. And lastly, the structure. That's the all writing, essentially, I'm not speaking of nonfiction, but all fiction, all storytelling, is about a story. And that has to be in there somewhere. People always remark about my style. That's a mystery to me, actually. It just seems a natural way to write. I don't attempt to create something utterly different. That's just my voice.
So substance, structure, style,
yes.
No sentimentality.
You're right. The fourth S we've left out.
We left that guy out.
Yes.
James Salter, thanks very much for being with us on The 11th Hour.
Thank you.
Last Night and Burning the Days are both published by Picador. And that's it for The 11th Hour this evening. The programme was produced by Siobhan Mannion.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie.